From Jefferson Public Radio, I'm Eric Thiel. Welcome to another live session. Today, we are coming to you for the very first time from the Steve Nelson Performance Space in the brand new JPR Studios. And my guest is none other than Laura Veers. Hello.
Hello, Eric.
It's nice to meet you. Thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having me.
It's fun to be in this room for the very first time.
It's bright.
And the setup sounded great.
Thank you.
We'll see how things go today. The new record is called The Lookout. Information is at lauraveers.com. This is record number 10.
Correct.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And produced once again, Tucker Martin, who is your collaborator in the studio and outside the studio as well.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit about Tucker's sensibility in terms of his hand on your music.
Well, he's my husband also, and we have two children, so we run a house together and our businesses, so it's all very intertwined. But we met in about 2001 or two, and well, 2000, probably 2000 actually, when I was living in Seattle, and he had a studio in his basement there, and we made my first album, proper album, called The Triumphs and Travails of Orphan May, which was like a concept record about a young girl traveling around the Old West. And I knew immediately when I met him that he was a special person. I'd never really worked with a producer before, but he has a way of hearing what a song needs in a way that I never do. I just write songs. I don't really think about, well, what instruments would be a good accompaniment to this, or should we add a harmony here, or how do you make the guitar sound really fuzzed out on this and that. And he's a really big music fan. He loves music. He has tons of records and loves every kind of music. And I think he really just has a way of listening to a demo and hearing what the song can be that is unique to him, and just very special. It's a gift to be able to make good records, and I feel lucky that I met him when I did, because I met him so early in my career that he's really been able to allow me to hand a record year after year to people with no disclaimers. I just feel very proud of all of them, and he has a lot to do with that because they sound really good.
Does he come at it from the perspective that a lot of studio guys do, where he can kind of play a bunch of different instruments, so he has a sense of how to coax out of musicians what he wants to hear from them?
He's not very much of a player. I mean, he's a great drummer, and he's drummed on almost all my records. He's a bit of an unsung drummer in a way, but I think he's kind of like a drummer's drummer. But he isn't known for his drumming, but he's a great drummer, but he doesn't play other instruments. He has a nice way, though, of... I feel like so much of what his job is almost like being a therapist, or almost like a magician in some way, of getting musicians to do their best work and pushing them in a way that allows the mood to still feel light. Because if they start to feel pressure or push too hard, then they're going to shut down, or they're going to get mad, or you know, it's just not going to go well. So he has a way of keeping everything very light and fresh and airy. And it's not to say that we don't sometimes get into arguments, because we do. We're human beings and we're married. But by and large, he has a really great way of encouraging people to do their best work, and understanding, because he usually hires a lot of the same people, he understands what their best work is.
Well, the record is beautiful.
Thank you.
There are all kinds of things going on it, which we'll talk about in just a minute. I would love to hear a song in its stripped down original form. What do you want to do for us first?
I'll do the first cut on the album. It's called Margaret Sands.
Scuttling claws have cleaned her hands, rising and falling in the whirlpool sand. You turn the wheel, your eyes of green and steel, consider Margaret Sands. How the gulls cry, how the sunlight fans, gliding above the bones of Margaret Sands. Now she's married to the swell, she's swaying in the shells, whispering the waves. How I listen as as I sail, straight backed and pale, ever opalescent gaze. How the gulls cry, how the sunlight fans, gliding above the bonds of Margaret Sands.
That is Laura Veers playing live for us today here on Jefferson Public Radio. Margaret Sands kicks off the new record called The Lookout. Information is at lauraveers.com. Tell me the backstory of Margaret Sands.
I was writing a bunch of songs for this album, and I had set up sort of a system for myself, giving myself little projects each day because, you know, I've been writing songs for 25 years, and after this long, sometimes it can feel daunting, like, the blank page. You know, I think even in the beginning it can feel daunting, but I really wanted to surprise myself, so I made up a system for writing where I had three different sets of cards. They were different colors, so the first set was lyrics, and they were yellow, and it was like a prompt each day that told me what to do with the lyrics. Like, for example, write from the obituaries or start with a line of poetry. And the next card was a different color, and that was the music card, and that was another restriction, like you write in 5/4 time signature or change the tuning on your instrument to an unfamiliar tuning. And then the next card is an inspiration card, because half the battle, I think, with songwriting or any creative endeavor over the long term is to feel positive and good instead of just like, I suck, or I don't like this, or this is too hard. You know, all those negative thoughts can really dampen the process and keep people from being productive, myself included. So the inspiration card might say, see it through, or accept that it's hard. And then I would use those cards to make songs. So this song, Margaret Sands, had started with one of the prompts was start with a line of poetry. And I was reading T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. And there's a song, a poem called Death by Water that resonated with me because I had a friend pass away recently. And it's a song about, or the poem's about a sailor observing the beauty of the day in terms of the light, the sunlight and the gulls, and listening to the gulls and seeing the ocean and appreciating his life while he's sailing over a skeleton. And so I thought that's pretty cool. I want to appreciate my life as I have it now and not just be so caught up in whatever distractions that I'm not even noticing the very beautiful things around me, like the sunlight or the birds. So the poem resonated with me, and I'm sort of morphed it into my own lyrics. So it's inspired by his poem, but I don't really think very much of it as actually his words.
The tools that you use, you either don't need them or they work incredibly well for you, because you wrote something like 100+ songs in preparation of making this record.
I did, but it's kind of a little bit of a...
I mean, that's a lot of music.
The thing is, like, sometimes I would write 5 versions of a song that day just to have a whole host of options.
Still, that's nowhere near writer's block.
That's true.
I mean, that's a lot of music.
That definitely wasn't my problem. I had a lot of other problems.
You talked in one interview that I read about the minimalist arrangements on this record, that mm-hmm. it's very spatial. I'm not sure that I buy that per se, because in listening to this, if you took you out of it, the lead vocal track out of these songs, there's a lot of stuff going on in the background.
Yeah, I think I wanted it to be more minimal than it ended up being.
Yeah, there are echoes, there are sort of ghost voices, there are children's choir sounds at times, mm-hmm. all sorts of stuff. Yeah. Did that come from you, or was that part of the production process with the team that you had assembled to make it?
Mostly the team, yeah. I mean, Tucker always invites people that we love, like a lot of our old friends who've been playing on my records for many years, and then some new guests as well. But I did a lot of it solo to start, and then we started adding things. And I think some of them are pretty stripped down. Like Margaret Sands is fairly stripped down on the recording. But yeah, you're right. There are quite a few extra elements in there. And there isn't a lot of drumming on this record, but there are a few tracks that have really cool drum, like programmed drum beats. And I wanted it to be fairly sparse. And I, of course, wrote the demos very sparsely. I don't ever really do big, fancy overdubs on my demos, but some of them did get pretty layered. Mm.
I'd love to hear another tune. Will you play something else?
Sure. This one's called Everybody Needs You. And this version right now is very stripped down. It's just me solo, but I think it holds up. And then when you hear the recording, it's full of all kinds of cool sounds.
This is Laura Veers playing live on Jefferson Public Radio, a song from the new record called The Lookout.
I seen you standing many times before. Your hands in the starlight, your feet on the floor. Everybody needs you. Everybody needs you. Pull your sleeves, your turquoise beams light up the gutter leaves. Everybody needs you. Everybody needs.
From The Lookout, that's Laura Veers playing live today in the Steve Nelson Performance Studio in the brand new JPR building. The new record is called The Lookout, lauraveers.com, the place to go online to find out more about the record and about her. I should say, you're playing a nylon string guitar.
Yes.
Has that been your go-to for a while?
It has been. You know, I kind of go on a pendulum from nylon to electric. Sometimes there's steel string in there. But this is the guitar that I grew up with in the house. So it's just the family guitar. My dad's like a novice kind of player, and my brother played. And that's how I got interested in it back when I was like 18. But it's my favorite guitar, and it's the one that I've written most songs on over the years and recorded most records with. Hmm. And it's just a crappy old 70s Goya, but it sounds really good. It has a lot of songs in it. Hmm.
A lot of folks over the last couple of years came to know of you and your music through the project that you did with Nico Case and Katie Lang. I think you even did a show at Brit here in Jacksonville.
Did. Yep.
You have talked at times about stage fright. That couldn't have helped to be on the stage in front of really big crowds with that trio.
It didn't help. It was super scary. I had like night sweats for 2 weeks before our first show. Our first show was in California, and the second show was not the Hollywood Bowl, but the Greek Theater in LA, which is a big place with the big jumbotrons. And I swear, I was like panicking every night before each show in preparation, just thinking like, I don't think I can do this. And because it has been an issue for me for so long, and it's not an issue for them at all. They love to perform. They're totally natural, especially Katie. She's like a born, gifted performer. And so I definitely struggled a lot with that feeling of like imposter syndrome. Like, I don't belong here. And this isn't for me. Although I had a big role in the songwriting, and that was where I was more able to like get over my issues and just write. And they had more issues with that. So it's interesting to see how certain artists, every artist has a cross to bear. And, they had their struggles with the writing or with other aspects of the project. I had my struggles with the performing, but I did it. You know, yeah. I don't really think other people would know that I struggle with stage fright from watching me play. I got over it enough to actually do my job, but it doesn't mean that I wasn't freaking out every time that I was doing it.
So other than obviously the critical acclaim for that project and the validation for being chosen for that project, what has that short era meant for you?
Well, I did learn about performing from them. I learned about different aspects of the music business, all the different ways that it can work, because that was such a more high level than I'm used to in terms of, you know, a big crew, lighting guys and, you know, tour buses and all that. We're back in the van now. It's a little more familiar. But it was interesting to also co-write. Like, I hadn't really co-written with people before, and to sit with people who are relative strangers in a room and come up with something from the heart was really challenging. But we did it and we pulled it off. And I feel proud of that, because a lot of times these, if you put it in quotes, these super groups fall apart because there just isn't a good chemistry. But for the three of us, I did feel like when we got into the writing process and the recording that we came up with something, an album that reflects the three of us and in our individuality, but also doesn't sound totally weird and like random. It sounds like a group coalescing into something new, which makes me feel proud of it. You know, I'm glad we did it. I don't think we'll do it again, but you never know.
I was just going to ask if there's a chance of revisiting that.
Maybe.
Down the
line. We've kind of talked about it, but I think there were some challenges too in terms of us having differences of aesthetic opinion and also just business decisions with the managers and all that, that kind of felt stressful. So you never know, but I think as time goes on, those kinds of differences can fade to the back. And you might be like, yeah, that'd be fun to do again.
Yeah.
You never know.
Well, in addition to Nico and Katie, there is one other woman I want to ask you about, which has been a project for you more recently, Elizabeth Cotton, a woman who is remarkable in many ways. And you actually wrote a picture book about her.
Yes.
For those that don't know Elizabeth Cotton and her place in the world of music, tell us a little bit about her and how you stumbled upon her story and decided to do a project.
Yeah. So she's a wonderful guitar player who was discovered by the Seeger family in the folk revival in the 60s. But her story was interesting because she was a self-taught African-American guitar player living in the segregated South in North Carolina in the early 1900s, and she picked up her brother's banjo and started playing it upside down and backwards because she was left-handed and didn't know any better, and became a virtuosic, not virtuosic, but sort of outsider folk master of banjo and fingerstyle guitar at a young age, and then put the instrument away as the pressures of life piled up on her, being a young mother and having to work. So she stopped playing guitar for 40 years and was discovered in a roundabout way by the Seeger family when she was in her 60s, and then went on to have this flourishing career and played songs for thousands of people around the world into her 90s and got a Grammy when she was 90. And Freight Train's her most well-known song. Freight Train, running so fast. Not everyone's heard it, but I had heard it growing up, and I had learned it as a guitar student when I was studying country blues guitar in Seattle in the 90s. And then I realized she had a connection to the Seeger family and that I hadn't known about. And it seemed like a fun story to tell. So it was illustrated by a New York artist named Tatiana Fazlalizadeh. And she did a wonderful job representing Libba. We call her Libba as a nickname, in her sort of genuine, calm, passionate way. It's a beautiful book to look at.
And did you tell her life story, or what was the story of the book? It's available through local booksellers or Amazon, stuff like that. Neat. You've also done a podcast, or are in the process of doing a podcast.
Yeah, I started it. I did a first season of 14 interviews with musician moms, and it's about the lives of musicians who are parents and how we juggle the competing demands of family and work.
You've got a couple of them, right?
I do have two young boys, 5 and 8. So it was, I was feeling a bit isolated in my quandaries around, like, how much do I tour and when and why and do I bring them or not? And, you know, I used to bring them when they were babies, but now it's too hard because they're in school and it's expensive to bring them. It's also tricky to not bring them. And there's just a lot of complexity to that, as there is for most working parents, but especially parents who have to travel, and musicians more and more have to make a living. So I really learned a lot through my interviews and started to feel a lot less alone in some of the struggles that I have and more connected to other women who are going through this. And I hope to do a second season of interviews with dads. But as you can imagine, I'm having a hard time juggling all of these competing things that I'm doing. So right now I'm just focusing on promoting the Lookout and doing this tour, and then I'll reflect on what I want to do next.
As you go out on tour now, do you feel like there's one eye focused more strongly on home because of the little guys?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I used to just be footloose and fancy free, but now I worry about them and I think about them and I call them, but I also, you know, feel grateful that I can do this and that I have a partner at home who supports me in doing this. And, you know, I support him when he does crazy long recording sessions, and, you know, we kind of both know what we got into when we got together and had kids. And I think it can be tricky when you don't have a musician in the couple, because they're like, why are you doing this? You know,
it's not exactly a 9-to-5.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely complicated. But I feel also, you know, like, it's cool that they can see their mom going off and realizing my ambitions and my dreams independent from them. As much as they want me to be home, I think it's cool for kids to see the moms doing their thing too.
Yeah. Do they like what you do?
I think so. The younger one.
You said one of them said the book was boring.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and I appreciate that. Like, I want their honest feedback. They do like my music, and they don't want, it's not like we just sit around like family music hour all the time, you know, because they think of it, and I do too, honestly, as more of my work. But I bring it into, you know, bedtime singing and beatboxing around the house and like a little dance party here and there. But it's not like every day we're just singing songs in this merry little rainbow family, you know.
Well, but that wouldn't be.
They put on my music sometimes. Like, they have CD players in their rooms, and the other day one of them had on July Flame, my record, and he's like, I really like this song, Mom. And it made me feel good that he was learning. He's 5. He was learning about some of my older records.
He's got good taste. I was just thinking, it wouldn't be too bad to be put to bed with a Laura Veers song.
Right?
That's not too bad. It's been a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming by. Oh,
thanks, Eric.
Laura Veers is my guest live today here on Jefferson Public Radio. Her newest release, number 10, is called The Lookout. Information is online at lauraveers.com. Will you play us one more?
Sure. This last one's called Heavy Petals.
Heavy petals, free your head. Legions of pasture call from the bed. Oh, heavy petals, just like me. Tenders rage that no one can see. Gas to go nowhere. Believe me when I say I at your dwelling place. Painted winds will come and we will fall through sunlight and Sirius will sunlight and Sirius will call. Oh, heavy paddles just like me. Tender's rage that no one can see.
That is called Heavy Petals. It's music from the new record called The Lookout of Laura Veers, my guest today live on Jefferson Public Radio. Information is online at lauraveers.com. Laura, thanks again for coming by. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too. Take care.